judge?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning, all. The panel includes Judge Williams. She is with us by speakerphone. Judge Williams?
Yes.
All right.
I'm right here.
All right. We will ask all counsel to project as clearly and loudly as they can, and I'm sure they will. We will start with the first case of the day for argument, Harrell versus the United States Postal Service. Mr. Leff.
Thank you, Your Honors. Projection has never been a problem for me, or so my teachers have told me. I'm here with Appellant Rodney Harrell. The issue is, do the regulations clarify the interplay of return-to-work provisions in a collective bargaining agreement and FMLA rights such that the Postal Service can rely upon return-to-work provisions in a collective bargaining agreement to diminish employees' rights to restoration? Answer has to be no. The statute gives a leave right, gives a right to restoration. There's a limitation on that right to restoration right in 26A4 that talks about limitations, that talks about the right of an employer to have a uniformly applied certification requirement. There's another provision that talks about that collective bargaining agreements cannot diminish Family Medical Leave Act rights. This court has harmonized those provisions by saying that a return-to-work provision of collective bargaining agreement cannot diminish rights. Now, the question is whether the regulations offer anything to call that decision in doubt. They do not. The regulatory framework is identical to the statutory framework. There is a restoration right. There is a limitation on that right with a certification, except if there's a return-to-work provision in a collective bargaining agreement. And there's a provision that says that collective bargaining agreement rights cannot be diminished. Family Medical Leave Act rights cannot be diminished by a collective bargaining agreement. Turning to the provision cited by the Postal Service, relied on extensively by the Postal Service, 29 CFR 825.310, the Postal Service tries to use subsection B in isolation, but it does not stand alone. That is the provision that addresses return to work in a collective bargaining agreement. First, you need to look at what that regulation's about. What is the heading? The heading is not under what circumstances may an employee return to work. It's under what circumstances may an employer require an employee to submit medical certification that the employee is able to return to work. That whole provision is about the provision of medical certification, a requirement that the employer, a right that the employer has to require medical certification. It is not about what are the conditions for returning to work. Provision addressing return to work on a collective bargaining agreement, and that provision is modifying the discussion about when a certificate can be provided. So if a collective bargaining agreement applies and a certification agreement can't apply, you still need to look if there are any other limitations. And, of course, there are. Just like in the statute, Regulation 825.700 discusses that no collective bargaining agreement can limit the rights provided by the FMLA. It's identical to what the statute provides. There's an example in that provision, 825.700, that states that illustrates that reinstatement to a position that a collective bargaining agreement that reinstates employees to lesser positions based on seniority cannot stand because that's a diminishment of the right. That is the example in 825.700. But what if the return-to-work provisions in the collective bargaining agreement stated that in order to be returned to work, in order to be returned to work, an employee had to be slotted back into a lesser position, possibly to be monitored for a period of time, possibly permanently. Well, if that was in the return to work provision, the Postal Service would argue that that must stand. In other words,
the position would become, the stipulation could be too onerous. It would be contrary to the FMLA. Is that your point?
Yes, sir. I mean, the return to work provision could have the exact condition that the regulation says would be unlawful, to a lesser position.
That presumes, though, that the union is in cahoots with the employer in some way, isn't it? I mean, a union that's doing its job of representing its people would not bargain away their rights under the FMLA.
I don't agree with that, because it could be a somewhere in the middle. What if it's a position that if you go out for stress or anxiety, that if you have a high level position, that you go into a lower level position to be monitored for 30 days to see if you can do the job? I mean, that would be that may not be in every collective bargaining agreement, but I could certainly see as plausible a union agreeing to a provision where an employer is demanding, we must be able to review this person to see if they can actually come back,
Are we looking for too much symmetry, perhaps, in this act? Maybe the unions just convince the drafters of this legislation to give them this special privilege, if you want. This is union power at work in the legislative process.
It's possible, but the statute says what the statute says. And I want to point out an illustration here that the Post Service tries to seize on incorrectly. The return to work, the certification provision talks about an exception if there's a valid state or local law or a collective bargaining agreement that governs return to work. And the Postal Service tries to say, there's this issue here about, state and local laws and safety and all this. But here's the key. There is no provision that talks about diminishment of rights under state or local law. There's no prohibition on state or local law diminishing FMLA rights, but there is for collective bargaining agreements. And for whatever reason, whether it's the court felt, I mean, whether Congress felt that the, I mean, you know, I think it makes sense that FMLA, provides the rights, provides the protection, and the 85% of employers that aren't unionized and the percent of other unionized employers that don't address this in their collective bargaining agreements, they have to follow the FMLA. I mean, so it would seem to reason that in the remaining employers where this applies, that Congress would not want the collective bargaining process.
Why couldn't Congress simply have decided to let a union water down the rights if that's what their workers are willing to tolerate from their union?
Well, then I think that there would be no provision in the statute that says a provisions in a collective bargaining agreement cannot diminish FMLA rights. The provisions of the statute don't contradict each other, and the provisions of the regulations don't contradict each other or the statute. The framework is exactly the same.
Well, the fact that the district court interpreted the FMLA one way and this court a different way in our earlier opinion suggests that the language is unambiguous.
I want to point out two things. First of all, the district court's decision was not contradictory to this court. What the district court said... I respectfully disagree. I think what the district court said was that what the Postal Service was doing was not onerous, was not a diminishment of rights, and therefore... You could have 2652, which says a collective bargaining agreement can't diminish rights, and that's fine. The district court just we believe incorrectly held that requiring the Postal Service to have carte blanche decision on whether an employee comes back to work or not was not a diminishment of FMLA rights. That's what the district court focused on. They did not focus on whether the return to work provisions in a collective bargaining agreement prevail over. Prevail even if they diminish rights. The district court did not address that.
What's unreasonable about the Department of Labor's interpretation of the FMLA?
What's unreasonable about it is that it goes against what the regulations say. The regulations clearly say that a collective bargaining agreement cannot diminish FMLA rights. There is another regulation, 825.312, which is right on point. Its heading is, under what conditions can an employer deny reinstatement? Nothing therein states that failure to follow the return to work provisions in a collective bargaining agreement are grounds for restoring and grounds for refusing to reinstate an employee to work. It discusses about an employee's failure to comply with the uniformly applied certification requirement from an employee's own health care provider, but it does not at all mention failure to follow the return to work provisions in a collective bargaining agreement.
Mr. Leff, if I can switch the focus a little bit, what is your response to the passages from the legislative history quoted by the government? Legislative history would seem to support their view of 2614.
I don't agree, Your Honor, on a couple grounds. First of all, nothing in the legislative history states that return-to-work provisions of a collective bargaining agreement govern restoration rights. What's interesting about the legislative history on this provision is that it is focused virtually, if not entirely, on state or local laws and the protections they can afford. And as I said, the statute does not have a prohibition on state or local laws diminishing FMLA rights. It does have a provision on collective bargaining agreements diminishing FMLA rights. The other point about the legislative history, as I said, it's really silent on this interplay with collective bargaining agreement. The legislative history talks very strongly about setting a level playing field for employers, setting up a leave and return to work restoration system that is relatively burdensome free for employees. And the minority comments on what the majority was doing is illustrative. The minority rails at some length that the entire system set up by the majority is one that allows employees to determine when they come back to work based on a determination by only them and maybe their doctor.
Mr. Leff, the government does make the argument at several points that your interpretation would require an employer to return someone to work to a position that required special concern for public safety, for instance, without a sufficiently thorough examination. What's your answer to that?
Well, that's a red herring. As trite as that statement is, I think that's the only conclusion. As we illustrate in our brief, there can be three similarly situated employers in a town, two unionized and one non-unionized, and depending on what's in their collective bargaining agreement, three similarly situated employees will be forced to satisfy different requirements to go back to work under the Postal Service's plan, under the Postal Service's theory. The non-union unionized employee would be able to go back with a certification from his or her own doctor if it's pursuant to a uniform plan. If it's not, they can go back at their will. And then, depending on what's in the collective bargaining agreement, what the collective bargaining agreement says at the other two or other 10 employers, everyone could have different rights. It could be your own doctor. It could be no requirement whatsoever to come back to work. It could be have to go through the employer's doctor and the person's supervisor. I mean, who knows, what onerous requirements. And the vast majority of employers in this country are not unionized and are subject only to the rights in the FMLA. AFL-CIO says generously private employers 9%, total employers 15%. I mean, this is just not a concern. This seems to have no relationship to a concern that Congress can have. It's not like a collective bargaining agreement return to work procedure is helping, keep out unsafe employers. I mean, unsafe employees from coming back to work. There is absolutely no relationship between
the two. What about
the
area of law enforcement? What are the statistics on unionization of individuals in law enforcement or fire departments?
I think it varies. I mean, I think there are just like in the general public, I think there's probably a higher percentage of law and fire, but there's probably less than 50% in this country.
But would that in any way speak to the government's concern?
I don't think so, because I think that state and local law, which there is no parallel provision to allow for the diminishment of rights under the FMLA, would take care of that. I mean, you know, that is the system that Congress seems to have wanted to set up. And I want to make one final point, that in order to go out for your FMLA leave, you have to get a certification from your doctor. The employer can challenge it, and then neutral can decide. That doctor cannot be employed by the employer, or be a doctor that the employer uses frequently, and yet the Post Service seems to say that to return to work, they can impose such a burden. It's just not in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Leff. Mr. Boardman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm not going to address Chevron Step 1 this morning, although I'll be glad to answer any questions about it. We do believe that should be the controlling analysis in this case, but
Let's talk about it just for a minute at least. I mean, if we just, you know, we just take a look at the plain language of the statute, just the words. It says you can you got to consider the collective bargaining agreement, but collective bargaining agreements can't diminish the rights of the employee.
The rights of the employees established under the Act, Your Honor, and we submit that Section 2614 and 2652 operate in separate spheres that do not overlap because 2614 specifically enables state law, local law, and collective bargaining agreements to regulate the return to work of employees. Congress deferred to those three institutions to establish the rules that would apply, and because employees are obliged to follow that, there is no right that's diminished under 2652B.
In other words, in your view, the right is established under 2614.
The 2614 establishes a precondition to the exercise of the right of restoration. An employee must first fulfill 2614A4 in order to have the right to resume work. If you don't fulfill the condition established in state law, local law, or collective agreement, then you have not you're not in a position to exercise the right to restoration. And that's why we don't believe that those two sections are in conflict, and this case can be resolved under Chevron Step 1.
That it can be.
They can be.
You believe, in other words, the statutory language is clear?
We do believe the language is clear and unambiguous in that regard, because no right is diminished when something is enabled by the Act itself. The Act enables state law, local law, and collective agreements to govern, and therefore employees don't have any right to ignore those things.
What then, at the practical level, would you consider to be the legitimate scope of Section 2652? What does it do in the statutory scheme?
It does just about everything else. For example, many employers in their collective agreements had less time off for work or had higher eligibility requirements. Those were changed by the statute. Other employers provided that they would not provide in their collective agreements, they would not provide for health insurance premiums when employees went on leave. That also was changed. This is the singular area that Congress carved out to defer to state and local legislation and to collective agreements to govern. Everything else is resolved by 2652B.
And yet there's not in the language, not a whisper of an echo of that limitation, is there? I mean, why didn't Congress, in drafting 2652, say, except as set forth in 2614. This is the rule.
I think it did, Your Honor, when it established that as a condition to restoration. And I point in that regard to the legislative history, which I believe this court may take into account in its Chevron Step 1 analysis. In the House report and in the Senate report, it was made clear that there were circumstances in which employees would be obliged to meet higher return-to-work requirements. And I think you can properly take that those statements
that
into account.
That raises an interesting question, and that is, in the Chevron analysis, to what degree can a court, as opposed to an agency, take into consideration that legislative history?
I'm aware that there's some conflict in this circuit, and we cited two illustrative cases in our brief, but I do believe Chevron itself says, as well as subsequent Supreme Court cases, that the court may apply traditional methods of statutory interpretation in its Step 1 analysis.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please.
Thank you, sir. Legislative history is a traditional means of analysis, and so we think it applies not merely to Step 2, but also to Step 1 as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. Turning quickly to our view that Section 825.310B is clear, unambiguous, and reasonable. We believe that that there are two reasons why this is clear and unambiguous. First, the regulation provides state law, local law, and collective agreement provisions dealing with return to work. Those provisions, quote, shall be applied, end quote. That is crystal clear that they're applied in all circumstances, not only some, that it may require more in the way of a certification or a physical examination. And the second has to do with the illustrations given in the regulation with respect to a physical examination. A physical examination is a little bit more intrusive, a little bit more demanding than a simple certificate. And that shows that the regulation anticipates something more than just a simple certificate. And that is reasonable and in conformity with the House and Senate reports.
Why would it not be possible to take the worker back under the FMLA, but then proceed to require a fitness for duty examination?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that you can't do that. It could give rise to interference claims, as we pointed out in our brief. But the key point here is, in terms of analyzing 2614, it is a condition to restoration. Because it's a condition precedent, that means that the employer properly may do that step first. And, of course, there would be some circumstances when any restoration might conceivably involve some danger. And finally, the Senate and the House reports also indicate that this is the first step in the restoration to work. You don't restore and then examine physically. You examine physically and then restore. I'd like to mention something that my colleague, Mr. Left, discussed also, and that has to do, 2614 does not, pardon me, the regulation does not simply mirror 2614. When you put them side by side and compare them, you will find that there are a number of significant differences. The regulations define what a certificate is. The regulations talk about shall be applied. The regulations give illustrations of a physical examination. They give an illustration of a laborer with a back problem, and on and on and on. There are a number of differences between the two. Finally, I note that the regulation that Mr. Left cites, 810.312, is not an exhaustive list. There are other things that are left off of that. For example, an employee who is unable to resume his normal job. And finally, the list in 810.312 also refers to 310. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You can finish your thought.
I was going to say that that list also includes the very regulation that I've been discussing here today. So it's not an exhaustive list, but it includes the one I'm talking about.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ho.
May it please the Court. My name is Joanna Hall, representing the Secretary of Labor as amicus curiae. The Family and Medical Leave Act's return-to-work provision is clear. It requires an employee returning from medical leave to follow the return-to-work procedures in his employer's collective bargaining agreement as a condition for restoration to his position. Even if this provision was not clear, the department's regulation is a permissible reading of the statute and is entitled to Chevron deference.
What do you say in reply to Mr. Leff's argument that this really allows a union to put in a collective bargaining agreement or agree with a corporation to put into a collective bargaining agreement conditions which would be absolutely contrary to the intent of the Congress in protecting workers in this important area?
The intent of Congress was to allow for a more specific medical certification where a state or local law or a collective bargaining agreement required that.
No matter how onerous.
Yes, the collective bargaining process should provide some backstop against extremely onerous requirements if it's working.
But in this day and age, we know that's not true. Sweetheart agreements between organized labor and corporations are something we see every day in this work, where they work to the detriment of workers, especially workers who aren't productive. The Department of Labor believes that Congress wanted that to happen, or was going to permit that to happen?
The statute states that collective bargaining agreements can control, and the legislative history does support that.
Does legislative history at any other point, other than what you've mentioned in your brief, get into this whole problem of things getting out of hand, of the collective bargaining agreement being so onerous that it negates the purposes of the Act?
Well, as Mr. Leff pointed out, 2652 does talk about collective bargaining agreements cannot diminish any rights provided by the Act, but that speaks only to the right to restoration itself. So if a collective bargaining agreement said that an employee who was otherwise qualified for the position, which is one of the requirements of the Act, and who had complied with the return to work process could still not return, that would effectively deny the right to restoration, and that could be a violation. But the statute clearly says that return to work processes in a collective bargaining agreement can control, and the intent was that the employee's union has bargained for those agreements, and oftentimes the union may trade a more onerous return to work process for some other protection under the Act.
Sure. That I think is one of our concerns, is to attribute in your name, in the Secretary's name, to attribute that intent to the Congress is what you're asking us to do, and
I think
we're having some difficulty with that.
The legislative history speaks pretty clearly to that, and if the collective bargaining process is not working well, that would seem to be more something under the purview of labor law. This court stated in Diaz versus Fort Wayne that a collective bargaining agreement applies and that the FMLA does not excuse an employer from neutral rules established in the collective bargaining agreement. So we maintain that 2614A4 is clear on its face. As I stated, 2652 does not conflict with 2614A4. A4 establishes a condition on the right to restoration. It does not provide the right to restoration itself. That is in 2614A1. And the right to restoration, as we know, is a conditional right. Therefore, there is no conflict, there is no diminishment of a right under the statute when an employer asks an employee to follow the return to work process in a collective bargaining agreement. The department's regulation at 29 CFR 825.310B is a reasonable construction of the statute and thus is entitled to deference under Chevron. The regulation is specific. It states, if state or local law or a collective bargaining agreement governs an employee's return to work, those provisions shall be applied. This language is exceedingly clear. It provides even more clarity than the statutory provision. 825.310B does not incorporate 2652B's limitation on a CBA diminishing FMLA rights, despite the fact that the department was well aware of this provision when it promulgated its regulations. Indeed, the department incorporated 2652B's limitation in other regulations, such as 825.204, which discusses employee requests to transfer to an alternate position, and 825.215, which discusses what qualifies as an equivalent position. The department did not include the limitation because it is simply not relevant to the return-to-work process. 310B also contains specific examples illustrating permissible return-to-work requirements under the Act. These examples state that an employee can require an employer to have an employee submit to a return-to-work medical examination as long as it satisfies the requirements under the Americans with Disabilities Act that it be job-related and consistent with business necessity. Clearly, the regulation allows specific certification procedures beyond the general certification otherwise allowed. The regulation is a permissible reading of the statute. 825.310B is consistent with the statute's language and the legislative history. Congress explicitly stated that 2614A4's second clause does allow a more specific medical certification. While 2614A4 allows more specific medical certifications, it also contains inherent limits on an employer's return to work process. The provision limits acceptable procedures to either, one, a uniform policy allowing a general certification from the employee's health care provider, or the process set out in a collective bargaining agreement or valid state or local law. And where a CBA determines the procedures, those have been bargained for by the employee's union. The department's regulation is entitled to deference. The department promulgated 825.310B pursuant to an express delegation from Congress and after notice and comment. Thus, under the Supreme Court's decision in Meade, this legislative rule is entitled to Chevron deference if it is a permissible reading of the statute. The regulation clearly satisfies this standard. Its interpretation of 2614A4 is consistent with the Act's language, structure, and legislative history. Even if the department's regulation were ambiguous, the department's interpretation of the regulation in its opinion letter and its briefs is entitled to deference under Auer versus Robbins. The department's 2000 opinion letter considered a scenario similar to that presented here. An employer asked whether it could require an employee to submit to a fitness for duty examination before being restored to his position after taking medical leave, where the CBA required such a process. The department concluded that a CBA could determine the return to work process.
The letter really deal with the issue we have before us, that is the interplay of 2614 and 2652.
I think it does speak directly to the issue before us. The department did not discuss 2652B in the opinion letter because there is no diminishment of a restoration right when the restoration right is a conditional right on following return to work process.
Your whole case really depends on our accepting that, right? That seems to be the fulcrum from your remarks and your colleagues. We have to agree with you that 2614 contains a right that has a precondition, and that precondition is compliance with the CBA.
We believe that's the correct reading of the statute, but even if this court were to determine that the statute is not clear on that point, the regulation would still be entitled to deference. It clearly states that a collective bargaining agreement can control, and there's nothing in 700A that contradicts that. 700A speaks only to the point that a CBA can't diminish rights, and the example is the right to reinstatement, not the return to work process.
Thank you, Ms. Hill.
Thank you.
Did you have a concluding remark? I don't want to cut you off.
I did, but I don't want to.
Well, you've come a long way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You may make that remark.
Thank you. In conclusion, the FMLA's return to work provision clearly requires an employee to follow the collective bargaining agreement's return to work procedures before being restored. The CBA provisions may be more specific than a general certification. The Secretary's regulation at 310B confirms this reading of the Act and is entitled to deference because it is a reasonable interpretation of the Act's requirements. If there are no further questions?
I think not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Mr. Leff, your time had expired, but you had a fair number of questions. You may have an additional minute.
Thank you. Your Honor, deference is not the issue. It's what should you be deferring to. The Postal Service and the Department of
Labor... Do you want to run that by me again?
The Postal Service and the Department of Labor want to isolate one section of a regulation and say this is what applies. They ignore the context it's in, the heading, the what's around it, other provisions. It's the interplay, and Matz, this court's decision in Matz says that such opinions of the Department of Labor have to be reasonable and persuasive, and our argument is that they're not. And the legislative history, again, it gives as an example for reasons such as public health, and they lump together state and local laws and collective bargaining agreement. They do not tie one to the other, and also the legislative history is very strong on that a collective bargaining agreement should not be diminishing FMLA rights. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Leff. Our thanks to all counsel. Wish you a safe journey back to the nation's capital.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.